Cape Talk. Pippa's Planet.
We're going to spend the next half hour in one of the richest ecosystems on the planet. It is vast, it is varied, it is home to numerous endemic species, many of them not particularly well known or even well documented by science. And it's a place you could visit a dozen times, scores of times, go back again and again, and always see something new and different. And if you think about how the modern world functions and the quest for the new and the undiscovered and the exciting, you would think that this is an ecosystem that would be overrun with tourists. And you'd be wrong, despite the fact that it's right here on our front doorstep. I'm talking about the undersea world right here around the Cape Peninsula and the underwater kingdom that it hides. My guest with me in studio is a man who has spent years getting to know that place, one dive at a time, one breath at a time, without the aid of a wetsuit, without any scuba gear, just a man diving down, swimming into a forest of kelp, being still and watching. And what he watched and what he saw and what he tracked is the subject of a book called Sea Change, Primal Joy and the Art of Underwater Tracking. Craig Foster is the filmmaker and photographer, partly responsible for the book, and with me in studio today. Craig, it's lovely to have you with us, and thank you for this extraordinary book.
Great to be here with you, Pippa. Thank you.
And I will straight away also mention that it is not only about the photography, as magnificent as that is. Ross Freilich, the writer, has woven a story, not just the story of the creatures beneath the sea, but a story of personal reconnection with nature and personal renewal that is as beautiful to read as the pictures are to look at. I mean, Craig, it is ridiculous that there is this vast, varied, wonderful ecosystem right on our doorstep, and so few people are exploring it. Why do you think that is?
It is a very cryptic environment. So sometimes when you first go into it, it's quite beautiful, can be very rough and cold, but it takes a long time to get to know these animals. So for the first, you know, maybe even 100 dives, you can be not seeing too much, and thousands of animals can be watching you.
Watching you, not knowing that, and you not knowing that they're even there. You choose to go into it in a very specific way, without a wetsuit, without scuba gear, just you entering their world. Why do you do it that way?
You know, I grew up right next to the Atlantic Ocean here as a child, and we didn't have wetsuits at that time. So it was kind of in my blood, in my family's blood, to do that. But there's something special about being in the water without the wetsuit. Once you get used to it, it's very unlikely you'd ever go back to that wetsuit. It gives you this incredible high. It sharpens your mind. It actually like upgrades your whole immune system, makes you much healthier, actually can repair your body. And it's better for the underwater tracking that I do to have that edge that the cold gives me.
It's incredible. I mean, reading in the book the story of how you and Ross first connected and came, you convinced him to come into the water with you, and he describes that moment of standing next to the water for the first time, thinking, this guy is nuts, I'm freezing cold and I haven't even got into the water yet, and how he, for a long time, could only push his body so far to make it 20 minutes, then 25, then 30 minutes, and he'd hit a sort of a mental barrier. He simply couldn't stay in any longer. And he watched you carry on diving for 40 minutes, an hour plus, wondering how you did it. And then slowly his body started to adapt and get used to it. There is a section in the book where he speaks about you're having a sense that actually this is where we came from, that this is something our bodies are meant to be able to do.
Very much so. I think that a lot of the triggers for all the systems in our bodies only trigger when we actually experience cold stress. Part of the study for the book is looking at the human origins, and I work with a big paleoscience team from WITS and other universities. And it would seem that certainly in the past along the coast here, it was sometimes a lot colder during certain times. And as humans living here, we would have been getting cold stressed every day. So once that's in the human design, then the body relies on that. And we have an amazing group of people who do this, and they've all started to feel a lot better and a lot healthier. But it takes time. It doesn't happen in weeks. It's more over a period of years.
You committed to diving 365 times a year for, I think it was 10 years in total. How far into that process are you, and have you stuck with that 365 a year?
Yes, I'm in about 8 years into that process. And it is really very much a commitment, but it's not that difficult, because you just get more and more drawn to it, and you get, you know, you crave the cold, actually, like you might crave the heat once your body gets used to it. You don't feel right if you haven't had it.
Part of the subtitle is Primal Joy, and there's some very moving passages in the book speaking where both of you, writing about both of you experiencing the sense of losing yourselves back into nature and sort of rediscovering a sense of connection to nature. How do you define that term, primal joy?
It's something that I first spoke about to a great friend of mine who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Hawaii, Professor Louis Herman, and he'd studied a lot of indigenous societies, and I'd spent many years up in the central Kalahari and in Bushmanland with incredible San master trackers, and had seen them in the wild, and this incredible feeling of joy that used to come upon them, even in times of adversity. So I'd studied it and seen it in indigenous people. And then after quite a few years of doing this work in the water without the wetsuits, we started to feel the first beginnings of that welling up. And certainly the cold, your whole brain chemistry changes. So if I took you in the water now, you know, within half an hour coming out, you'd feel a big shift in your mood, and you'd feel this, you'd feel that. It's not an uncommon thing.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because I'm thinking I sup a little bit and I do it in Komaki without a wetsuit, and that's pretty cold water.
Great.
And I feel amazing every time I come out, even if I've been wiped out and tumbled around and knocked to pieces. There is just something, that sense of a shift in my body that I can relate to, although you guys have clearly taken it to a different level in this consistent going back in. It's not only what's going on in your body, it's the sense of the stillness and the watching and the patience that you take into the water, Craig, that shines through in the photographs you share in this book, because of course it enables you to capture moments that others would have missed because they'd already swum away, or they'd gone past too fast, or they hadn't stopped to follow those tracks. Let's talk a little bit about that process, because you speak of watching tracking in the Kalahari. You've then taken those principles you learned there and applied them to the ocean.
Correct, yes. I mean, in the Kalahari, my son teaches there, you know, you'd see them using the wind and the insects as the timekeepers. It's very different in the water. It's more the mollusks and the swell and all these egg casings and the kills that the animals are leaving. So it took quite a long time to realize that there were even tracks in the water. And then slowly over time, you just build up literally thousands of these tiny little marks in on the kelp, in the sand, everywhere, and they tell you what animals are there and what they're doing and what they've done, say, in the night. You can even project into the future and figure out what they might be doing.
It also means you've captured footage that I would imagine nobody's ever shot before, Craig. I mean, there are photos there of a puff adder shy shark laying an egg, caught midstream, as it were, which I can't imagine too many people have had the privilege to see, let alone be still enough and patient enough to actually capture. What was it like to you to be witness to those events and know how rare a privilege it was?
I mean, it is an incredible privilege. I think people, for instance, have seen some of the smaller sharks laying eggs. But there are other things like the octopus armoring. I don't know if you've seen those shots where the octopus picks up, you know, 100 or so shells and stones and makes this incredible armoring. And we did some of that work for the BBC Blue Planet series. The feeling is it transports you into the secret world of these animals, and you fall in love with them. And say something big like seeing that thing with the octopus, or seeing some of these animals hatching out of their shell eggs, like the tuberculate cuttlefish. That, you're kind of on a high for 2 or 3 weeks after that, and you share those stories with people, and it is a really great privilege, and it's a very special thing to experience.
So an SMS asking, is this the octopus guy from Carte Blanche? You are the octopus guy from Carte Blanche. Your octopus teacher comes through in the book as well. For those who didn't see the Carte Blanche segment, Craig, won't you just tell us a little bit about that particularly special encounter, well, encounters?
Right. Part of the Greater Sea Change project is actually a film that I've been doing with Pippa Ehrlich, who's a great, really talented young filmmaker and part of our team. And it's the story of this extraordinary octopus that somehow, through a lot of time and energy, but a very special animal that trusted me and let me hunt alongside it and bear witness to this incredible secret world. Most octopus, when you go near them, they see you as a predator and they'll just move away. But this animal, it was like a perfect storm. It was in the perfect area, and I visited it every day for a very long time. And then one day it reached out and made contact, and then eventually came out of its den and allowed me to follow it. And then I could see this incredible behavior, much of which is not recorded by science.
That's not the only encounter of its kind that you mention in this book. There is a remarkable story of an otter coming to you in the waves as well. And instead of, as you say, seeing you as you would expect it to, as a predator, something that I should run away from, coming to you and touching you. It was beautiful to read. It must be very hard to even encapsulate what that felt like and what that meant to you. But why? What do you read into that encounter?
Yeah, it was very confusing at first. You know, why would an animal be curious enough to do that? Why would it come up and make contact and touch one's body for quite a long period of time? And it, what I eventually concluded was that otters actually have a very long history of hunting cooperatively with humans. And there's still a few places in the world, like Bangladesh, where this still happens.
Really?
So I think what's happening is this animal is somehow connecting or remembering that deep evolutionary memory of hunting with a human, and it's starting that very slow process. So it was, it took quite a long time to figure that out, and a couple of special people helped me to figure that out. But I think that really is the case. And if you look, there are amazing cases around the world of people hunting cooperatively with dolphins, even with barracuda, with many animals, actually. And I'm sure, you know, this coast, what a lot of people don't realize is this coast here in South Africa probably has the longest tradition of interaction, human-wild interaction of any place on this planet. And we have the science to back this up. So you can, if you just let your imagination go a little bit, can you imagine the kind of relationships that people had with wild animals? There was enormous amounts of food. There wasn't competition with a lot of animals for food. So I think there was plenty of opportunity in this kind of Eden for humans to have very special and unusual relationships with animals, and quite possibly with otters.
If you've just joined us late to the conversation, my guest in studio is Craig Foster, who is part of the team behind a new book called Sea Change, Primal Joy and the Art of Underwater Tracking, an extraordinary hardcover book. It's published by Quivertree. You know I love their books. They feel wonderful. They smell wonderful. They always look beautiful. This one is no exception. And chatting about what is now 8 years of going into the water day after day after day, diving into the kelp forests here along our coastline and being there as a witness to the animals, tracking what the underwater life is doing and capturing many spectacular moments on camera. Terence is wondering, is there a big difference between the cold water and the Indian Ocean in terms of what you see in terms of animal and plant life? Terence, thanks for your SMS.
I think people think that False Bay is the Indian Ocean, but it's also the Atlantic Ocean. But I know what he means. It's definitely, certainly in summer, it's warmer in False Bay, and then it cools down in winter. And sometimes both sides are equally the same. So there's more biodiversity on the so-called Indian or warmer side, which is actually the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. But there's more biomass on the West Coast because we get this incredible upwelling. So okay. Less species, but an enormous amount. I mean, in some areas, I think it's up to 50 kilograms per square meter. If you compare that to the Serengeti of, say, 5 kilograms per square meter of animal mass, that's an extraordinary amount of nutrient welling up and just feeding this incredible system every day.
Well, I mean, if anybody watched the latest Blue Planet series, they would have seen even down at 1,000 kilometers below sea level in the middle of the Antarctic, the coldest water you can imagine, there was rich and abundant life. The fact that we don't get close enough to see it doesn't mean it's not there. Craig, the one thing we haven't spoken about is the human story woven through the animal encounters in this book, and particularly Ross's story of having been abandoned by his father in childhood, and through this process of going out diving and watching with you, discovering a sense of wanting to reconnect and search again. I know it is his story to tell. I don't want to ask you to take too much of it and share it, but can you just explain for us what happened and what you saw happen personally for Ross in the process of compiling this book?
Yes. I mean, this is something that was such a wonderful thing to see. You know, when I first I've known Ross for a very long time. And then we reconnected. And just to see someone come in the water so often and see someone who's been through quite a difficult childhood and just get transformed by this incredible ecosystem and by the cold and by these amazing experiences and this fantastic friendship that we had was really special, you know. And I think we all carry difficult things from our past, and you know, we've seen that a lot. There's something about this incredible ecosystem and these animals and this wild place and this wild, I mean, it's the Cape of Storms after all. Something happens when you enter into this environment, and we've got an incredible community of people, from young people, teenagers, to people in their 70s. And what's so interesting is when you also go into this environment, those generational gaps break down and you start to speak about these wonderful animal stories, something we've done for, you know, thousands of generations. So it's an amazing bonding process. And that's, I guess, what happened with Ross and myself. We definitely started to heal part of both of our sort of fractured souls.
And the story of that healing is worth picking up the book alone, let alone the photographs of the underwater life that go with it. I'm aware of the fact that the book is, as you said, one element of a broader sea change project. Craig, won't you explain to us what that's all about?
We had this kind of pipe dream, in a way, of putting the great, what we call the Great African Sea Forest, on the world map. My wife Swati, who's worked in conservation in India for many years, spoke to us and said how important it was for a place to have this iconic status, especially if you're trying to conserve it. And she's seen that in Asia a lot. And What we thought, well, could we possibly do that? Could this place ever be synonymous with the Great Barrier Reef or the Serengeti or the Amazon? It seemed impossible. And then Blue Planet came out and we were part of that, and, you know, it crashed the internet in China, and, you know, hundreds of millions of people saw this incredible sea forest, this kelp forest. And then we started to do this book, and now there are a lot of big international players interested in developing films and media around this. So this crazy pipe dream that we had, and Ross was very much part of developing and sculpting that idea, that's almost starting to happen now, which is incredibly exciting. I think we've got a long way to go before it's, you know, because people still don't know. You say this name, people don't know what you're talking about. But it's happening slowly. And we are trying really to get the word out there and also to just show how precious it is. It's not only the biology and the biodiversity, but it's also this extraordinary prehistory. There is no place on the planet that shares this kind of biology and this human prehistory. There's no place that compares. And it's, in a way, I mean, if you had to have one place on the planet for any human living anywhere in the world to visit, you could choose this place, because it's the science shows that this is where the first art, the first science, the first deep connection with the wild took place. So it's absolutely unique, and it's in that regard. So a lot of people don't realize what we have and how incredible it is.
Well, this book is certainly going to shift that mindset for those who are exposed to it. Craig, it's been a delight having you with us to talk about it. Look, the hardcover book is, it's large. It is packed full of hundreds of magnificent photographs. It is a big book, and it has a big price tag, 850 Rand. But you are bringing out an ebook version as well, I believe.
Correct.
Okay, so that's going to be available at a lower price tag of 375 Rand. That's on pre-order at the moment, I believe, via the Sea Change website. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, so if you're wanting to get the hardcover version I've been talking about, which is simply hands down one of the most extraordinary books I've ever had the pleasure of holding in my hands, it is available in major bookstores or via the website seachangeproject.com. You can also go there to pre-order the ebook version, available on Loot as well, I believe, Craig.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The author, for those asking me, please to repeat his name, Craig Foster, and Ross Freilink is the writer who worked with him on the project. Craig, final question from somebody on our WhatsApp wondering, do you actually prefer being in the sea to being on land? Answer carefully now, because your wife is sitting next to you. She's nodding.
The strange thing is that I feel safer in many ways in the sea than on land. And it's maybe a strange thing to say. Obviously not when it's very rough, and that can be very scary. But a lot of the time, it's just so safe and peaceful in these kelp forests. And look, only spending an hour or so a day, time is different. It's completely different in there. It feels like many hours because there's so many animals, and it's so profound sometimes. I'm happy, of course, to come back to land. You know, you an hour or so, you do feel it, and it's very overwhelming. So I wouldn't say I prefer it, but it's like home to me. If that was taken away, a huge part of my life would be taken away.
Well, thank you for sharing that glimpse into this part of your life that you've done in this beautiful book. Craig Foster, it's been a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Pippa.
The book is called Sea Change, Primal Joy and the Art of Underwater Tracking. And that's made us just a tad late for the Eyewitness News headlines. My apologies. Wesley Peterson.
Thanks, Pippa. Good afternoon. President Cyril Ramaphosa has warned gangsters in communities across Cape Town to be very afraid. Ramaphosa earlier today officially launched the police's anti-gang unit in Hanover Park. The unit has been operational since the 8th of October and has already executed more than 50 arrests in suburbs across the city. Acting head of the SA Revenue Service, Mark Ingen, says SARS stands ready to rejuvenate itself and go forward with absolute professionalism. Kingen will not be drawn on the mood within SARS today following President Cyril Ramaphosa's decision to fire its suspended head, Tom Moyane, yesterday. He says the organization is looking to the future. And the German state of Hesse has voted to scrap the death penalty from its constitution, amending a 69-year-old legal anomaly which allowed it. The Western state is the last in Germany to amend its legal or local legal code after the national constitution abolished capital punishment in 1949. Some 83% of voters were in favor of changing the 1946 provision, referendum results have shown. The vote is a symbolic one, as federal laws have always trumped state ones. Between 1946 and 1949, two people were sentenced to death in the state, but the rulings were later commuted to life sentences. These and other stories at 3 or as they happen.
EWN Traffic.
The N1 outbound is slow moving between Plattekloof Fields and Durban Road. The M5 southbound is heavily congested between Dick Burton and Hyde. And the M5 northbound is congested between Barkley Road and the Kubek Interchange, so delays expected there. The Fishhook roadworks continue until the 31st of January with a break between the 14th of December and the 11th of January. Weather permitting, one lane will be closed in both directions between Quarry Road and Corsair Way. Wesley Peterson, EWN Traffic.
Thank you so much, Wesley. John and I are sitting here comparing notes on exquisite, extraordinary, beautiful books about the natural world. And I know you.